Welcome to The Clever Cookster, your source for everything new and noteworthy in food and cooking. I'm your host, Kara Rota. We're joined today by Michael Booth, a food and travel writer and journalist whose latest book is called Super Sushi Ramen Express, One Family's Journey Through the Belly of Japan. Thanks for being here, Michael.
Hi, Kara. Thank you for having me.
A quick word from our Clever Cookster podcast sponsor. You've probably heard of the Entertainment Coupon Book. The Entertainment Coupon Book is packed with hundreds of coupons for local restaurants, shopping, attractions, zoos, golf, movie tickets, travel, and more. Now, saving is even easier with the Entertainment Digital Membership. With the digital membership, you can print coupons online or redeem them right on your phone. Save up to 50% on the things you do every day. The Entertainment Coupon app is packed with thousands of dollars worth of savings. You can save locally and when traveling, so membership includes access to nationwide coupons. A coupon membership quickly pays for itself. I've saved on some of my favorite brands like The Gap, ordered flowers online, and even gotten movie tickets. As a special offer to Clever Cookster listeners, get 25% off an annual digital membership, regularly $19.99 per year. Just visit savingonthego.com/clevercookster. Select your market to see local savings, choose your membership, and then enter promo code COOK at checkout. That's COOK at checkout. You spent 3 months traveling Japan along with your wife and two young sons, exploring regional cuisines and how the food culture there has evolved over time. How did you make the decision to undertake this trip as a family?
Oh, from my point of view, it's just a very selfish decision, really. I like my family. I don't like to travel away from them. And if I can include them in my work, whenever I can, I do. So I've dragged them to live in Paris when I was doing a book about cooking school in Paris, and I've dragged them around India when I was doing a book about India. And so I learned while I was doing that it's actually great to travel with kids because you see the world through their eyes, but also you interact with the world in a very different way when you have kids traveling with you, especially in Japan. And my kids are half Scandinavian, so they're very blonde. So they got a different reaction from people there. So that's why the two reasons really why I chose to travel with my family.
You note that the quote-unquote traditional Japanese diet is very much in line with food trends that we talk about now as if they're modern. Things like farm-to-table and whole foods and clean eating, just the idea of using really fresh ingredients in their natural state. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I suppose the greatest thing, well, there were two things that really grabbed me originally about Japanese food. I'd spent a year or so cooking in French kitchens and living in Paris and eating a lot of cakes and pastries and fatty foods and foie gras, and I'd put on a bit of weight. And I discovered this book called Japanese Cooking, a Simple Art, Japanese Food, A Simple Art, excuse me, by Shitsuo Tsuji. And even though the book was written in the 70s, it described a really, to me, very modern way of cooking and eating. It was very seasonal. As you say, it was very simply cooked, lots of vegetables, lots of fish, not so much meat, not so much fat or dairy or sugar and all those kind of things. And it seemed to me, firstly, a good, healthy thing to do for myself after that year of indulgence. And secondly, I thought, well, you know, there's a lot the rest of the world can learn about how the Japanese eat. And then, of course, I discovered things like, you know, they live longer than anyone else on planet Earth. They have the greatest longevity and lower incidence of cancer and heart attacks and all those kind of things. And diabetes is very low and obesity is very low in Japan. So I thought, oh, there's an awful lot that we can learn here.
And yet, as you talk about, the Japanese consumption of rice has gone down so drastically from 330 pounds per person per year a century ago to 132 pounds today, while fish consumption has more than halved and meat intake has more than doubled. What factors have played into that shift and what repercussions are we seeing as a result of it?
Well, it's kind of the similar thing that's happened in the West, only they've taken a while to catch up. You know, prosperity came to Japan relatively late in the 60s and particularly the 70s. And with that kind of economic boom, you had an urbanization, you know, people working much more. And then you had the rise of fast food and the influence of the Western diet, which has had kind of a pernicious effect. It's had a positive effect, but also a pernicious effect in Japan. So the Japanese have been in the last 20 years, 30 years, eating more meat, more fast foods, pizza, burgers, all the usual culprits, and they've become you like, infected by those bad habits as well, just not quite as badly as people in the UK where I'm from or in the States.
I love the part of the book where you actually go and visit the headquarters of a company that produces MSG to try to get to the bottom of why MSG has been so demonized in the popular American imagination for so long. And there's a quote from a spokeswoman who suggests that the backlash might have something to do with the fact that the U.S. didn't discover it first. And while we're so open to all of these chemical innovations that are, in many cases, very pernicious, this one that has come from elsewhere has just been always so demonized. That made so much sense to me when I read it. Can you talk more about that?
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, particularly in the 80s, when the Japanese economic boom saw a lot of Japanese investment in America and that great kind of economic and corporate rivalry took place, maybe there was an element of, dare I say it, racism in attitudes towards MSG. I don't really know. It is, seen from the outside, it's kind of ridiculous that the Americans would take against a particular food additive when the American diet is so pumped full of all many other much more serious food additives. And the truth, as I think most intelligent people now realize, is MSG is not that much more processed than salt and certainly doesn't lead to all the weird side effects that were erroneously attributed to it back in the 70s and 80s, like the famous migraines and things like that. It's just another seasoning. And I use it myself at home. I give it to my kids, no problem, in small doses. If I feel a dish needs a little kind of umami boost or a little is lacking something that salt can't bring, I'll sprinkle in a little bit of the old MSG.
Let's talk about umami, because its role is so important in Japanese cuisine, and it also seems inextricably linked with dashi, which is sort of this ubiquitous cooking stock that's the base of so many dishes. How does umami work? How does it relate to MSG? How does it relate to dashi? And what does it really provide to this food?
Oh, my God, Kara, that's a big subject about umami, the fifth taste, right? So back to basics, we have these five tastes, salty, sweet, bitter, sour, and then there's this fifth one, this savory flavor, if you like to think of it, if you could call it. It's the taste of tomatoes and parmesan. It's the taste of roasted meats. It's the taste of human breast milk. It's very umami rich, and the flavor comes from amino acids, glutamates, which the body needs because they're kind of an indicator of protein. Just as the sweet flavor is the indication of sugar and energy, and the bitter flavor is the indicator of toxins and poisons. So it's a really important purpose, and it's umami is present in a huge range of foods. But the Japanese and the Italians actually kind of stumbled upon a way to really unlock a massive umami synergistic effect, it's called, when you combine different types of amino acids to create, am I getting too technical here, maybe?
No, please.
To create this incredible flavor explosion. And the classic example is a dashi, which is a Japanese stock or soup, which is an infusion of, well, the most powerful umami one is an infusion of dried shiitake mushrooms, dried kombu or kelp seaweed, and katsubushi, which are fillets of bonito fish, which have been dried and inoculated with a kind of fungus, which in a way ferments their surface and turns them into something that resembles blocks of wood, which you then shave, a bit like pencil shavings, into the stock to infuse them and strain it, and you make this incredibly powerful, almost meaty flavored soup, which, as you say, is the base for lots of simmered dishes and sauces and glazes in Japanese cooking.
You've probably heard of the Entertainment Coupon Book. The Entertainment Coupon Book is packed with hundreds of coupons for local restaurants, shopping, attractions, zoos, golf, movie tickets, travel, and more. Now, saving is even easier with the Entertainment Digital Membership. With the digital membership, you can print coupons online or redeem them right on your phone. As a special offer to Clever Cookster podcast listeners, get 25% off an annual digital membership, regularly $19.99 per year. Just visit savingonthego.com/clevercookster. Select your market to see local savings, choose your membership, and then enter promo code COOK at checkout. for so many years, sushi was sort of the iconic Japanese food in America. It was really the only food that we associated with what Japanese people eat. And now that has expanded to some extent. But having spent so much time now in Japan and having lived in so many other places, what are the foods that you think are really iconic in Japanese cuisine that are maybe going to be adopted more, are going to get more recognition globally?
Well, of course, currently, obviously, ramen is the big one that's been a massive success in the States in the last 5 or 10 years, and still has a long way to go, I think. You know, there's a ramen restaurant in Tokyo that just got its first Michelin star. Then you've got yakitori, which are the grilled skewers of meat and vegetables, and rarely fish, actually. What else? In Osaka has three amazing fast foods, which I don't understand why they're not in every American city. And they are okonomiyaki, which are these kind of thick pancakes with often with pork and seafood and noodles mixed into the batter. And then you have kushikatsu, which are breaded, deep fried skewers. And then you have takoyaki, which are kind of savory donuts, small savory donuts with a chunk of octopus in the middle. And all three of these Osakan fast foods have these amazingly Moorish, addictive brown sauces, which you either dip in or pour over them to eat. And they're just, my mouth is watering just talking about these things. But then, you know, if you go right to the end, the southern end of Japan, you have Okinawa, which has its own really rich and very specialized cuisine. They eat a lot of pork there. They have amazing purple sweet potatoes, which are extremely rich in flavonoids and very, very healthy, a lot rich in vitamins. You have an incredible seaweed called umibudo, which looks like caviar. They call it sea caviar. You eat it raw and it just pops in your mouth like caviar. Yeah, and then if you go all the way up north to Hokkaido, again, you have this different natural bounty of amazing raw produce, sea urchins. I'm literally, as I've talked to you, I've just been writing about sea urchins in Hokkaido, and they have a special type of ramen there. Of course, they have amazing king crabs. Seafood is just some of the best in the world. And that's one of the great things. There are 40-something, 45, 46 prefectures or regions in Japan, and each one of them has this fiercely proud food culture. They'll all have their own specialities. That's why you can kind of make a whole lifetime studying and traveling in Japan, and you still find something new every time you go there. I've been there 3 times this year. I'm still making new discoveries.
I'm always so fascinated with the ways in which the media around food interact with the reality of what people eat day to day. And I think a lot about food TV. Long before the popularity of shows on the Cooking Channel and Food Network now, I remember Iron Chef being such a huge phenomenon. What's happening with food TV in Japan now, and how does it interact with the cultural reality of what people are eating and cooking?
Food TV in Japan, and I've been sucked into it a few times in the last few years, appearing on it, is beyond crazy. It's insane. You flick through the channels on TV, and literally every channel, every other channel, there will be a food show, whatever time, day or night. I can't begin to describe how, you know, not just TV, but magazines and books, that the Japanese are just crazy about hearing about food. All the while, as is happening in the West, they're making less and less food at home themselves, but they're eating out more, and they kind of religiously follow these shows. Many of the shows will go around again to the different prefectures and just visit restaurants and eat the stuff, and you see the fat comedian eating, you know, what the obscure udon dish on Shikoku or whatever, and then the next day those restaurants will have massive queues outside of them. It's extraordinary. You know, you're right to point out this direct contact between food TV and what people do in Japan. They really follow whatever they see on screen, and that becomes the flavor of the week.
So many Japanese chefs focus their careers on the mastery of a single dish. There are so many examples of, you know, someone spending years and decades perfecting the broth before they even go on to making the next part of it. How do you contrast that with the way that chef culture, as we often know it here in America, is often about mixing and matching different inspirations and constantly innovating to come up with new dishes and this very sort of anything goes approach. What do you think those two philosophies of chef culture do to the development of food?
Well, you're totally right. It's a total polarization between attitudes. You know, we're generalizing here, but between attitudes of chefs in the West and chefs in Japan. It really comes down to what do you want from your restaurant? Do you want perfection, or do you want to be surprised and see innovation? In truth, there isn't a great deal of innovation. I'll get hung up for this, but there isn't a great deal of innovation in Japan and in Japanese cooking. Often what it takes is for a Japanese chef to go to Paris or New York, and then they'll have their eyes opened, or Spain, obviously, or Copenhagen these days where I live, and then they'll go back to Japan and they open kind of hybrid restaurants. Most of these seem to be based in Tokyo and Kyoto. Whereas, you know, in the States, yeah, I mean, sometimes it seems everyone wants to just become famous as quickly as possible by making a cronut or innovating something wild and crazy. That doesn't happen so much in Japan. I like a bit of everything in my food world, so I like to travel around and try. But, I mean, I have so much admiration, not just for Japanese chefs, but just Japanese craftsmen and their lifelong dedication. You know, I meet people who make mochi. I met a guy recently who makes mochi. He gets up at 6 o'clock every morning, has a little cafe in a not very salubrious neighborhood of Tokyo. He's been doing it for 20 years, and just incrementally he works every day to make his mochi as best as he possibly can make it. And that includes going and meeting the rice farmer that makes the rice he uses, you know, making sure the water is filtered properly, the temperature of the kitchen is correct. And he's never going to get rich. He's never going to get famous. He's just going to bring pleasure to the handful of customers that come to his shop every day. And I've seen that, the length and breadth of Japan, and it's so refreshing, isn't it? You know, when I don't want to sound like an old fart here, but, you know, in the West, you know, social media turns us all into a bunch of self-obsessed kind of narcissists who just want to be famous and, you know, want our 15 minutes. And it's just the antithesis you find with these amazing craftspeople in Japan.
What were the major takeaways after you researched this book and spent the time there doing this research? What are the things that you think that people in the West could really look to, either the traditional Japanese diet or the way that it's evolved, to think about the way that we eat?
Oh, God, again, that's a really, really huge subject. You know, the basics that we, that what I see that's great about the Japanese and how they approach food is, number one, seasonality. The Japanese, rather like the French, have this kind of deep-seated, ingrained awareness of the food seasons, so that, for example, they have these things called spring mountain vegetables, which I love, which are kind of bitter forage. They used to be forage fiddlehead ferns and things that grow in the forests in the springtime. And they might have a season of 2 weeks. Some things have a season of even less, but people will anticipate them. They'll know when the season is starting. They'll pay big bucks in the first few days of the season to get that first precious taste of the season. I think that awareness and attachment to nature is really something to be admired. And again, the regionality, the fact that wherever you go, there's a pride in something special that they make in that, even just down to a single town on the island of Shikoku. They have one town that makes this amazing special kind of udon, which has recently become really popular in Tokyo. What else? I mean, the fact that they... Well, I once interviewed a very great Japanese chef, and I asked him. He'd worked in France. He trained in France. He has one of the great restaurants in Kyoto. And I asked him what the difference is between French chefs and Japanese chefs. He said the Japanese chef will always work just to bring forth kind of the essential flavor of the produce that God has created, whereas the French chef thinks he is God and will want to transform and combine and complicate the produce. A lot of the top end, the Japanese chefs, they believe their mission really is to bring forth the essential flavors of this really great produce. On the other hand, if I'm being critical, I think the food waste in Japan must be pretty horrific, because they demand that their fruits and their vegetables are absolutely perfect. You know, I just visited this famous Yubari melon region of Hokkaido where they grow these $100 melons, which are given as gifts and almost like jewelry in Japan. And I hate to think the waste that happens there. Plus, there's a lot of additives in Japanese food, and you know, a lot of pesticides and insecticides to keep these fruit looking perfect. Someone did tell me there were more additives in Japanese food than any other food in the world. So, you know, they're not perfect either, but I still think there's so much that we can learn from them. Also, just about making stuff that tastes really, really great, you know, bringing forth the umami flavors in food. They're the world's experts.
Michael, thank you so much for talking with us today. It's a really fascinating book.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for your time.
Check out the book, Super Sushi Ramen Express, One Family's Journey Through the Belly of Japan, and tune in next time on The Clever Cookster, your source for everything new and noteworthy in food and cooking.